Our speaker for this morning, who's to speak on the sexual dysfunctions in the chemically dependent, is Dr. Richard Morin. He is the medical director of the Brighton Hospital in Michigan. He's a native of Michigan, graduated from medical school at the University of Michigan, was in general practice in the Michigan area for several years, then went to California, I believe, for a few years before he came back to Michigan to become medical director of the Brighton Hospital. Their hospital is about the same size as Charlotte Treatment Center, and he says that there is a great deal of similarity in our treatment regime, the whole physical structure, and I think that this is a up-and-coming thing if we can have more of these. With the advent of 500,000 new alcoholics each year, we're going to have an awful lot of hospitals to keep up with the growing population. I'd like to introduce, my distinct pleasure, introduce Dr. Richard Morin.
Good morning. I'm Dick, and I'm an alcoholic. Dr. Taggart mentioned that I spent a little time in California. That was a geographic cure, if anybody is interested in that. Jan Clayton mentioned that her experience here in Charlotte has been a spiritual experience, and if I were to tell you about that experience in California and give you my drunkalog and let you know that, and then realize that I'm on the program with such a charming, beautiful lady as Jan Clayton this morning, you would understand that would be a true spiritual experience. You just can't believe what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I have been treated just beautifully here in Charlotte, and it is my pleasure to be here, and I appreciate the invitation to come here. A lot of people wonder how I got interested in this subject of sexual dysfunction. Anybody who can't read this up there, don't worry about it. I'm going to repeat all that verbally, so it's not important. I guess it's there more for my memory than it is for your benefit. But at any rate, a lot of people wonder how I got into the subject of sexual dysfunction, and the answer is obvious, because for the same reason I got into the subject of alcoholism. One of the things that occurred to me when I stopped drinking is a couple of months later I developed what could be called a semblance of a normal sex life, which I had never had before in my whole lifetime. And so when I started working in the field of alcoholism, I started promising everybody that their sex life would get terrific and normal. And that happened for most of them, but a few of them didn't. And so I thought I should look into it a little bit more, and I did sign up for various sex therapy clinics around the country and seminars, including Masters and Johnson's in St. Louis. And so that's the type of thing that I'm going to share with you this morning. Now, I'm not going to bore you with my own sex life, although I'm not so sure it would be boring. So I'm not really going to tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. But I will tell you one thing, that last year for my birthday, my wife bought me a T-shirt. You know, I got a lot of teenage kids around home, and T-shirts are the craze. And she bought me one last year for my 50th birthday, and it said, I may not be perfect, but parts of me are excellent. And this year, the nursing staff at Brighton Hospital bought me one to match it, and it says on their sex instructor, first lesson free. So it seems like this reputation is spreading, but I think it's a very important subject, because it's one of the things that you can promise a recovering alcoholic that's positive. I mean, it's one of the best reasons I can think of to stay sober is getting back a happy and successful sex life. So what we're going to talk about, though, is sexual dysfunction and how alcohol prevents us from enjoying our sex life. And basically, It's not surprising that alcohol should have certain symbolisms as far as our sex life is concerned, because it's always had a reputation of being an aphrodisiac, you know, making sex life better. And as a matter of fact, some of the recent research coming out of Masters and Johnson's has shown that indeed 2 ounces of alcohol does increase the male hormone level in both sexes, so small quantities does act as an actual aphrodisiac. So there's some basis for sayings like Ogden Nash said, candy is dandy, but liquor is quicker, you know. There's some basis for that, but except Shakespeare said many hundreds of years ago that alcohol provokes the desire, but it dampens the performance. And this is what actually happens with us alcoholics, is that our sex life becomes literally impossible once we increase the alcohol intake above a couple of ounces for a very long period of time. And then once you increase the alcohol above a few ounces, the testosterone level, instead of going up, goes down and has that effect that Shakespeare noted. As I said, alcohol has this reputation of being a sign of virility, at least to the male, and the average male coming into a treatment center doesn't mind saying that he drinks a pint or a fifth of liquor a day. What he don't want to admit to is that it gives him any loss of control. Well, the opposite is sort of true of the female. You know, ever since Victorian times, the female is supposed to not admit that she enjoys participating in sex. She's supposed to endure but not enjoy. You know, Queen Victoria admonished her daughters on their wedding night. She said to them, don't worry about it, just close your eyes and think of England. That was the attitude of sex for many years, so the female was not supposed to admit that she enjoys sex. Well, alcohol made a convenient excuse for them, because they could always say, the female could always say, well, it wasn't my fault, he got me drunk, you know. Well, that sort of makes an ideal situation if you stop and think about it, because a man and a woman can sit around the same table drinking out of the same bottle, that bottle being a sign of virility to the male and a sign of loss of control to the female. It sort of makes the prey a better prey, the predator a better predator, and there's no doubt that alcohol is always going to be very successful in our social sexual lives, unless, of course, you become an alcoholic, and then the opposite of that comes true. When I first started putting this talk together, and I give a talk similar to this to patients at Brighton Hospital, I thought I would say anybody not having any problem with this subject could get up and leave, but I realized right away that'd be a mistake, because all the guys would want to impress the gals that they didn't have any problem and they'd leave, so I didn't think that was a very good idea. And I thought I'd say anybody not having any interest in this subject could get up and leave, but I knew that would be a mistake too, because all the gals want to impress the guys that they didn't have any interest, so I thought I'd better not say that. And actually, the reason I make that comparison is because I wanted to see how much double standard there is, you know, whether they really believe that or not. And so I would take it from the response there that the people in this room have agreed that sex is something that's okay for both parties, and it's all right to talk about it, and that's what I intend to do right now. That always brings me to a little story. It reminds me of a story that I usually tell about women enjoying sex, and it's about a couple of females who own this pharmacist, and they worked alone in this pharmacy, and one day a man came in to be waited on. He looked around and saw only these 2 women working in there, and so he thought he'd go out and go someplace else. And he started to walk out, and one of the ladies went up to him and said, "Can I help you, sir?" And he said, "Well," he said, "I'd rather have a man wait on me, if you don't mind." And she said, "Well, we're both pharmacists, my sister and I. We work alone in this drugstore, but I'm sure we'll understand your problem and be able to help you if you tell us what it is." And he said, "Well, okay." He said, "Do you have anything for a permanent erection?" She looked at him and said, "Well, I think we can help you there, sir, but I'd rather talk it over with my sister, if you don't mind." So she went and talked to her sister, and she came back, and she smiled at him real nice, and she said, "How about $5,000 and half interest in the store?" So with that in mind, we'll now talk about sexual dysfunction. And for the most part, I have a habit a lot of times of talking about the guy and he and that. And I want you to know that with very few exceptions, everything that happens to the male as far as impotence happens to the female as far as sexual dysfunction. So if I make that error, please bear in mind that I am talking about both sexes, and where I am separating them, I definitely will discuss that. But what we're going to talk about is sexual dysfunction, of which there are 2 types, primary sexual dysfunction and secondary sexual dysfunction. primary sexual dysfunction is defined as that type of sexual dysfunction where that person has never been able to function normally sexually in their whole lifetime. This indeed is very rare and probably almost non-existent among alcoholics. So you'd think I could go right on to the second type, which is very common among alcoholics, but there's something to be gained from the fact that something is rare, because after all, if something is rare, that almost always means that the opposite of that is common or normal. And that's the point I want to make right now. Sex is a common, normal function, and it's something that starts at birth and ends at death. And the reason that's important, because any alcoholic who has problems with his sex life, if it happens to come on when he's 45, 55, or 65 like that, he may think it's his age that is causing the problem, and will not realize it's the alcohol, and therefore it won't have any desire to do anything about it. And so it's important to convince everybody who has a sexual dysfunction that sex is a normal function and it doesn't stop at any particular age. Masterson himself was a gynecologist and an obstetrician before he was a sex therapist, and he used to tell the story about how he would get bored delivering babies in the middle of the nighttime, and he'd make a bet with himself whether he could get the cord tied on newborn baby boys before they had an erection. And he lost 50% of the time. So sex then can start very, very early, and it can go on until death, and it doesn't stop at 45, 55, or any age like that. When I was down at Masters and Johnson's in St. Louis, the oldest couple they had in treatment down there was a man who was 86 years of age, and he was in treatment with his spouse who was 94 years of age. And I might say categorically that they were indeed successfully rehabilitated. So age has nothing to do about it. I heard recently somebody compare sex after 55 with the new speed limit. You know, they say sex after 55 is like the new speed limit because it may take you longer to get there, but you got a lot of gas left over after you arrive. And I think that's a pretty good analogy, and it's another way of saying that the quantity may decrease a little bit, but the quality improves enough to make up for it, so nobody is suffering a great deal. Another analogy to sex in the elderly that I thought was especially apropos is what Alex Comfort talked about in his book, Joy of Sex and More of the Joy of Sex, which incidentally I think are two excellent textbooks for people who have problems with sexual dysfunction and communication, because they're well illustrated books on sexual techniques. But anyhow, Alex Comfort in that those two books says elderly people stop having sex for the same three reasons they stop riding a bicycle. Number one, because they think it looks silly. Number two, because they are in poor physical health. Or number three, because they don't have a bicycle. And I do indeed think that's an excellent analogy. The second type of sexual dysfunction is called secondary sexual dysfunction, and that's a type of sexual dysfunction that comes on later in your lifetime after a period of functioning normally or pretty good anyhow. When I was in medical school, they talked about secondary sexual dysfunctions as caused by such things as aneurysms of the aorta, prostate gland disease, multiple sclerosis, diabetes mellitus, and things like that. Well, those things, of course, still do cause secondary sexual dysfunction, but now we realize they make up a very small percentage, maybe 10% or less, of the secondary sexual dysfunctions in the country, and the vast majority, probably 80 or 90%, are caused by alcohol and other drugs. And that's what we're going to talk about this morning. And I've written up on the board here the five different ways alcohol and other drugs interfere with sexual function. The first is intrapsychic. The second is state-dependent learning. The third is organic. The fourth is functional. And the fifth is a specific type that I'll talk of when I get there, which means that it's a dysfunction with one person where the person may be able to function with other people, strangers, and so forth. So let's talk about those one at a time. And the intrapsychic sexual dysfunction really refers to hang-ups that a lot of us have and through our developmental years. Freud has a lot of terms for them, you know, like homosexual panic and penis envy, castration complex, Oedipus complex, and those fancy words simply meaning that during our developmental years and our adolescent years, we have some fears about our sexual identity and our abilities that makes us worry a little bit. about our ability to have sex, and that usually will go on to a minor or greater degree, depending on the individual, until the opportunity for sex arises and it's successful, and then we don't have any problem with it anymore, and those fears are laid to rest, right? Except, of course, if you become an alcoholic or a drug addict, and at a later time in your life, find that you're not able to perform sexually, there can be a rebirth of those hang-ups that you or fears that you had during your developmental years, and you begin to wonder what's wrong with you and why is there something wrong with my identity? Is there something basically underlying wrong with my psyche that I'm having these problems? And you know what a lot of people do in situations like this? They start reading all the textbooks and dictionaries and all things like that, and they read about words like latent and overt, and they read about things like homosexuals and bisexuals and heterosexuals and pansexuals and trisexuals and all those things like that. If you want to know what a trisexual is, by the way, that's somebody who will try anything. They read about all these things and they wonder, could I be one of those people, you know? So this sets up a form of fear of performance, and they wonder whether there's something underlying wrong with them. Well, the most common, females and males have two different situations here, because the male usually has more fears of performance than the female, because he has realized for a long period of time that one of the basic differences between the male and the female is he has to have the desire to have sex before he has the ability to have sex, right? So what he when he finds himself unable to perform sometime, he begins to wonder whether he is a homosexual a lot of times. You know, back when that was a worry for a lot of boys when they were in their teen years and that, because, you know, back then they heard some words out behind the barn and that, like fag and queer, and they were swear words, at least they were used as swear words, and they wondered whether they didn't know what the words meant, but they knew they weren't very nice. Then they got to their adolescent years, and they realized they had to have, the difference between a boy and a girl was the boys had to have the desire before they had the ability, and they knew about this homosexual thing, and so they wondered, could they be, and then that all was laid to rest when they had their opportunity for their first sexual experience and found indeed they were heterosexual and that was no problem. But when they became alcoholics and they found their sex life was unsuccessful, and even a lot of times they even got to hate females because of all the hostility and aggression that goes with an alcoholic marriage, you know, sometimes not only did they weren't able to perform, but they actually got a strong hate for the opposite sex. Then that idea of being a homosexual became even more important in their thoughts, you know. And as a matter of fact, if any of you around 20 years ago and knew anything about and read any psychiatric textbook that time, you'll remember that all the psychiatrists at that time thought that all alcoholics were homosexuals, males and females. And this, of course, that was a misinterpretation. Now we know that they aren't homosexuals, but at that time the psychiatrists thought they were, because they knew that most alcoholics had impotence or none and were non-orgasmic, and they misinterpreted that to mean that they were homosexual. This is what's called homosexual panic, and this happens to a lot of alcoholics, especially male alcoholics. If they find themselves unable to perform sometime, there can be a rebirth of this situation. These thoughts. A second type of thing that applies to the males, and I'm going to get to the females in a minute, because the interpsychic hang-ups I'm talking about right now do differ from the male and the female for the reasons I've just stated. A second type of hang-up that occurs in males that usually doesn't occur in females is the castration complex. And you know, every male has an image of himself of what it is to be a father and a husband and a male and all those things, and it usually means he has a job and he supports his family and he disciplines his kids and all that sort of thing. Well, any alcoholic that gets into trouble with alcoholism soon finds that he is not living up to his own image of what a male, a husband, and a father is, and so he feels castrated. And if you feel castrated, of course, act like you're castrated and you become unable to perform. The situation with the female as far as interpsychic hang-ups are slightly different, because in the first place those words, swear words about homosexuals are not going around in their peer groups in childhood. Secondly, females always have the ability to perform even if they don't have the desire, but the society has laid a couple of problems on the female just as serious as those that I've mentioned on the male, and one of these is the virgin whore concept. The idea that when a virgin gets married, when when a woman gets married, she's supposed to be a virgin. If she isn't, she's a whore or something like that. Well, this creates somewhat of a problem in a lot of females, or at least it used to, they say, and that's going back to that advice of Queen Victoria to their daughters. But I'm not so sure that this is as important as it was once made up to be. As a matter of fact, I'm not so sure it ever was important, frankly, because I happen to live in Ann Arbor, and outside of the Natural Science Museum at the university there, there's a couple of great big bronze lions that guard the door there, you know, and legend has it in Ann Arbor that every time a virgin goes by, those lions roar. Well, I've lived in Ann Arbor now, off and on, for over 20 years, and I want you to know that I've never heard those lions roar yet. And I understand they've been standing there for some 90-plus years, and I doubt very much whether anybody has ever heard those lions roar, so I'm not so sure the virgin whore concept ever was really important, you know. However, I do have to be perfectly honest with you, because a year or so ago, I told that legend at Brighton Hospital, and there was a man there, a patient who was from Ann Arbor, and he came up to me after the talk, and he said, "Doc, apparently you haven't heard the other side of that legend." I says, "No, I guess I haven't. What is it?" And he says, "Well, the only men who can hear those lions roar are the men that have been faithful to their spouses," or whatever that is. But society has laid a problem on the female that indeed is especially serious for the female alcoholic, and that's the concept that she will meet a man someday, marry him, and live happily ever after. This is sometimes called the "someday my prince will come" theory. No pun intended. The idea that someday some man will come and kiss her on the cheek and she will live happily ever after creates somewhat of a problem for the alcoholic female, because she's been raised, in other words, to believe that if she ever has a problem after she gets married, it's his fault, not her fault. Well, that's a problem, because it really, in most cases, isn't his fault, it's alcohol's fault, and she's been raised to believe otherwise, so it's very, very hard for her to see the alcohol as the problem. And the end result of this is the alcoholic female becomes very, very depressed, because after all, if you've got a problem that you think is caused by somebody else, that means you can't do anything about it, and why not get depressed about it? That's one advantage the male, I guess, has, if you stop and think about it, because if he becomes impotent, if he can't get it up, he may not know what the problem is, but at least he knows it's with him, you know. And the female, when she quits enjoying her sex life, when she becomes non-orgasmic, the way she's been raised is she is prone to see this is caused by her spouse. And so 90% of the females, I think for this reason, become depressed, and are harder to get to treatment for that reason, and are harder to treat in some cases. And this is verified, of course, by the statistics on depression, which shows that 60% of all the suicides in this country are performed by alcoholics, and 60% of all the suicides by alcoholics are performed by females. So while the general population, males are more successful in committing suicide than females, in the alcoholic population, females are more successful in committing suicide than are males. The other 10% do the obvious thing. They go out and look for another prince, and that's usually called a barfly. But that isn't very successful either, because the problem is not with the prince. The prince may have a lot of problems, but that has nothing to do with what we're talking about. So looking for another prince is not going to solve this problem. Treating the alcoholism is. So those are examples of interpsychic hang-ups that I have found important in treating alcoholics. The second group I have up there is called state-dependent learning. And this is a phenomenon that's been shown in the research laboratory, and it was brought out to me clearly by David Smith, who runs the Haight-Ashbury Clinic in San Francisco. And David Smith pointed this out, that the young drug culture kids especially are suffering from state-dependent learning. And that state-dependent learning simply means that you remember things you learn sober better when you're sober, and you remember things you learn drunk better when you're drunk. In other words, if you take some mice or rats and teach them how to go through a maze when they're drinking and sober them up, they won't know how to go through there very well until you give them something to drink again, then they'll remember how.
vice versa. If you teach them how to go through there sober and give them something to drink, they won't remember how to get there through there unless you sober them up, and then they will. Well, this happens to drug culture kids especially, because they have started on drugs, many of them, when they were 12 years of age and so forth. So they've absolutely never have had a sexual experience sober. And as a result of this, they are suffering from state-dependent learning, and they feel that they can't have sex unless they're under the influence of drugs. And to a certain extent, they're right. They'll have to stay sober long enough and relearn some of learn some of those things that they learned while drinking, have to learn them sober, and then they would be able to function. So there's a group of people out there who absolutely swear to the fact that they can't have sex sober, and to some extent they're right, but they just don't understand this mechanism, and it's simply a matter of learning. I remember once there was a doctor at Brighton Hospital a number of years ago who, after he heard this, told me about an incident he had. And he had come to Ann Arbor for a postgraduate course, and he was at a bar and he was drinking heavy and got drunk, and he met this female in the bar, and he thought that they would get to know each other better if they went out to her trailer, which they did. And he apparently had a lovely time that night, and he promised her the next night he'd be back. Only the next night he couldn't remember where she lived. He went back and forth out Liberty Street, and he couldn't find where it was at all. So he was rather disappointed and thought, well, that was too bad. So a couple of years later, he went back to Ann Arbor for another postgraduate course, and he went back to the same bar, and he got drunk again, and all of a sudden, he remembered where she lived. And so he leaves the bar and gets in his car and drives out Liberty Street right to her trailer. The only thing is, she had moved since, and so it didn't do him any good. But this is an example of state-dependent learning, where a person, where you remember things better sober when you learn sober, and you remember things better when you're drunk. This is sort of one of the explanations of blackouts, of course, of which there are many. The third type of sexual dysfunction I have up there is what I have termed organic. And organic means there's some actual changes in the body caused by alcohol and drugs that prevents a person from performing sexually. And the organic sexual dysfunction can be divided into two types. Number one, the desire to have sex. Alcohol and drugs affects the desire to have sex. Number two, it affects the ability to have sex. Okay, the desire to have sex, in turn, is affected by alcohol in two different ways. One, through the testosterone mechanism that I already alluded to a little bit, and second, through the addiction mechanism that I will talk about in a minute. First, going back to that testosterone mechanism, I already mentioned that 2 ounces of alcohol increases the male hormone level in both sexes. And, of course, both sexes have male hormone. Now, the female usually produces about 50 milligrams of testosterone a day, and when she drinks more than 2 ounces of alcohol, it lowers that to 25 milligrams percent, and if it's that low, then she loses sexual desire. The male usually has about 200 milligrams of testosterone. If he drinks 4 or 6 ounces or more, that drops down to 150 milligrams percent, and he loses sexual desire. So this process has been shown by Dr. Kolodny of Masters and Johnson. You might be interested, by the way, where he got that information. I thought it was interesting anyhow. He got the idea, I should say, from a study done at Duke University, as a matter of fact. And it was done about 30 years ago. And the study was done on a group of elderly females. They had 30 elderly females around Duke area there that had advanced breast cancer, and they had been operated on. The operation was unsuccessful, so they were looking for some chemical they could give these 30 elderly females that would slow down the growth of that breast cancer and prolong their lives. And they knew, of course, that female hormone made breast cancer worse, so they theorized that maybe large doses of male hormones would make the breast cancer better. So they put these 30 elderly females on this hospital ward, gave them all large doses of male hormone, and found two very interesting things. Number one, it did indeed slow down the growth of that breast cancer and prolong the lives of those elderly females. Number two, it made those 30 elderly females very horny. And they chased all the young orderlies all over the hospital wards. Now, I have these statistics on how well testosterone worked as far as the breast cancer is concerned, but I've never been able to find out how well the ladies scored as far as the orderlies are concerned. The second way that alcohol affects the desire to have sex is through the addiction mechanism. And the addiction mechanism goes something like this. If you have a desire to have sex, this is felt as an increase in tension, which is an arrow pointing up, right? And that tension goes on until...
I thought I felt something going.
That tension goes on until you have sex, and then the tension goes down, like this. Now, what happens if you become addicted to alcohol, is if you feel like you have to have a drink, that is felt as an increase in tension. That tension goes on until you have a drink, and the tension goes down. Now, you notice over here, there's arrows going down in two places. That if you can't tell, this poor guy doesn't know whether he's horny or thirsty at a time like this, because he if he satisfies his drinking tension, it automatically satisfies to some extent his sexual tension too, because the human body really can't tell the difference. Now, if you're looking at this blackboard over here, you say, yeah, but what about the next morning? There's two arrows pointing up over there. And indeed, there is. The guy is hypersexual, or gal, is hypersexual the next morning. The only thing is, he found out one other thing, too, that by this time his spouse is so mad at him that it doesn't do him any good anyhow. And furthermore, it won't be too long before some of the other things I'm going to talk about will start setting in, and then he'll lose sexual desire. So alcohol, we're still talking about the organic effects, there's actual changes in the body that affects the desire, as I just mentioned, and now we're going to talk about the way alcohol and other drugs affects the ability to have sex. And the alcohol and other drugs affects the ability to have sex in three different ways. Number one, through the testosterone mechanism, which gets worse, and I'll describe that in a minute. Number two, through the effects on the hypothalamus. And number three, through the effects on other vital organs, especially the liver. So we'll talk about those. Now, the daily use of alcohol, and incidentally, this experiment was done by Dr. Kolodny of Masters and Johnson's, and he started doing it on marijuana and heavy joint smoking, in other words, as well as heavy alcohol intake, as well as heavy Valium and Librium and other drugs do the same thing. But anyhow, the large doses of alcohol will lower the male hormone level in both sexes for the following 2 months if you drink daily for a two-month period of time. And if the male hormone level is down for that long of a period, then that person will lose not only sexual desire, but sexual ability. I think this has an important point here as far as recovery, because a lot of people are going to wonder, it's all very well to tell me what happened, but how long is it going to take me to get better? And the answer has got something to do with this this male hormone level. Actually, after 2 months of heavy drinking, the luteinizing hormone of the pituitary gland drops down, and so if you stop drinking, it really takes about 2 months before sexual ability comes back. Sexual desire, however, comes back in about 5 days after your last drink. And that's very interesting. It's very important, too, to the staff at Brighton Hospital, and I'm sure it is to the staff at Charlotte Treatment Center, too, because the desire comes back in 5 days, but the ability doesn't come back until 2 months. And if you want to know why the treatment plans are 4 weeks instead of 8 weeks, it's got something to do with this, because we at Brighton Hospital happen to think that's a gift of God to Brighton Hospital, that the ability doesn't come back to 2 months, and that's why we have no plans of extending the stay a two-month stay. The second way that alcohol affects the ability to have sex is through the effects on the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus is an area of the midbrain that contains a lot of important structures, including our sensual appetites and food and everything else. And I'm sure a lot of you know about the norepinephrine and serotonin hormone that goes along with addiction, but when you become physically addicted to chemicals, what happens is during your withdrawal period, your norepinephrine and serotonin hormone go up, and those chemicals, those neural hormones, have a depressant effect on the hypothalamus, which knocks out your sex life. About the time you start losing weight as a result of drinking because of loss of appetite, that's when this effect starts happening on the sexual desires too. And the only reason I mention this at this time is because there's a type of sexual dysfunction that's peculiar to males that can be extremely important, and that's it's related to this area, and that's a condition called premature ejaculation. And there's about 5% of males have had this problem all their life. And what they have found is that alcohol and Valium and Librium and that type of thing actually helps this premature ejaculation, makes it better, right? So when you're treating an alcoholic who has premature ejaculation, and he found that it's a little bit better when he drinks, he's going to be very reluctant to give up alcohol because he's worried about premature ejaculation coming back. Well, the reason this is important is there's a much better treatment now for premature ejaculation. It's called the squeeze technique. It's described by Masters and Johnson's in their book, Human Sexual Inadequacy. And it's worthwhile knowing that because for the males who have this problem, to know there's better treatment than alcohol, which didn't work very good anyhow, is comforting, because now if they do stop drinking and they get a recurrence of their premature ejaculation, too close to that, if they get a recurrence of this premature ejaculation, then they can use this squeeze technique that will work better anyhow. And we can discuss that in the workshop this afternoon if anybody has any particular interest. The third way that alcohol affects the ability to have sex is through the effects on the vital organs. And the most important one probably in this regard is the liver. At least that's the more popular one. And the liver, of course, is where the body gets rid of all the hormones and toxic chemicals and products of the body and of daily metabolism. And this, when a healthy liver, there's no problem. But if you get cirrhosis of the liver, then some of the things can accumulate, and of course that's why your tolerance to alcohol goes down when you get cirrhosis. Well, you can't get rid of your hormones either, and the male produces female hormones just like the female produces male hormones. And the male usually produces about 35 milligrams of estrogens, female hormones, per day from his adrenal glands, and a good healthy liver gets rid of about 35 milligrams per day, so there's no problems. However, if the male develops cirrhosis of the liver, his female hormone starts accumulating, and he starts becoming effeminized. In other words, his body hair becomes sparse, his beard becomes sparse, he develops breast tissue, just like a female, his testicles get small and atrophy, and he becomes impotent. And I'd like to say about these poor, unfortunate individuals, as far as wine, women, and song is concerned, they can sing a little bit, and that'll be up an octave or two. Okay, the fourth way that alcohol affects our ability to our sexual lives is what we call the functional dysfunction. And a lot of people who are familiar with the word functional dysfunction usually think that that's all in the person's mind. But this is not true, because there's some actual changes in the body caused by fear that it results in functional dysfunction. In other words, if you've been reading much of the sex manuals around since Masters and Johnson's, you'll find an awful lot of references to fear of performance. Well, that's what functional dysfunction is talking about. It's talking about fear, and it's the idea that if you find yourself at any one time unable to perform, then when the opportunity to perform the next time comes around, you're going to be afraid because you don't want to embarrass yourself. You might not be able to make it, you know. And this creates somewhat of a problem, and it actually causes changes in the body that prevent you from performing. And you know what happens when you're afraid? Your adrenal gland puts out adrenaline so you can fight back or run like hell. He knows about as much about sexual dysfunction as he does about alcoholism. The first thing his friendly family doctor said was, "John, how old are you?" And John said, "I'm 55. And the guy said, "Well, John, what the hell do you expect, you know?" So now the poor guy's sex life is knocked out completely just because he got some poor advice from his doctor. Okay, how does this refer to us alcoholics? Number one, several ways. Number one, there are about 3% of alcoholics who become alcoholics when their spouse dies, so they'll get a double dose of sexual dysfunction because, indeed, they got the problems with alcohol and they got the problems with the use-it-or-lose-it phenomenon. Two, they say in AA there's no such thing as an uninvolved spouse. Well, they say the same thing down at Masters and Johnson's about sexual dysfunction, too. They say if you got it, there's no such thing as an uninvolved spouse. If you got a sexually dysfunctional man, you got a sexually dysfunctional wife or significant other, or vice versa. Well, that's certainly pertinent when it comes to alcoholics, because certainly the alcoholic can be in treatment, and he can find out that he can get over his fear of performance because all of his problems were due to alcohol or her problems were due to alcohol, only to get home to find out his spouse or her spouse is sexually dysfunctional because, after all, they've been married to a corpse for several years as far as their sex life is concerned. So it's important to recognize this. But the real connection comes when John the alcoholic, 55-year-old John the alcoholic, goes to see his friendly family doctor. And, of course, what's he going to do? He's going to quit drinking for, you know, a day or two before he goes to see his doctor, if he can, because he wouldn't want his doctor to think he had an alcohol problem. So he'll quit drinking, he'll go see his doctor, and he'll say his name is John. He's still 55, and the doctor will examine him, and he'll notice that he's got a little tremor there, and so he'll write down tremor on John's chart, because he'll have a tremor, of course, because he's withdrawing. He'll examine him some more, and he'll notice his blood pressure is up, and his pulse is up, because he's withdrawing. And so he'll write down high blood pressure on John's chart. And so he'll talk to him some more, and then he's going to notice how depressed John is, because, you know, alcoholism causes depression and all of this. So he's going to write down depression in John's chart. So before John leaves, he's going to say, let's see, John, you were here about your inability to perform sexually. How old did you say you were? 55? What the hell do you expect, John? But you've got a couple of problems that need treatment here, and that one of those won't be alcoholism, because it's most unlikely that John would let on that he has a problem, and it's most unlikely that the doctor will see the significance of those three classical symptoms I just described. So he's going to say, and John, you need something for this tremor here, so here's a prescription for Valium or Librium or something nice like that, you know. So now John's problem is just doubled by the results of this trip to the doctor's office. But the doctor isn't done yet, because he's going to say, and John, your blood pressure needs treatment. Here's a prescription for Eldomet or Ismolin, guanethidine, Rowulfia, Catapress, Reserpine, one of those beauties, and they're just about as bad as the others for causing sexual dysfunction. So now John's got a triple dose of sexual dysfunction, but the doctor isn't done yet. He says, and John, this depression needs treatment. Here's a prescription for Melaril or Thorazine or Bifactyl or Tofranil or Elavil or Triavil or one of those beauties, and if John is ever able to function again, it'll be a sheer miracle. He's been decommissioned for the rest of his life, simply as a result of that visit. Okay, those are the four types of sexual dysfunction that I used to talk about, and I would go to Al-Anon meetings a lot of time and get talks similar to this, and almost invariably, after the Al-Anon meeting, some lady would stand up or come up to me, and she'd say, well, Doc, if alcoholism causes all this sexual dysfunction you're talking about, how come my husband has these three or four girlfriends I keep hearing about all the time? Well, I used to answer that question like this. I'd say, well, two reasons for that, probably. Number one is that he probably is using those new girlfriends as pornographic material to sort of stimulate what is otherwise a waning sex life, you know. And I said, secondly, he probably isn't any more successful with them than he is with you anyhow. And that still is a pretty good answer to that question. But now I realize there's another type of sexual dysfunction that I call specific sexual dysfunction that I had written up there. And specific sexual dysfunction refers to one person only. This person can function with strangers, but not with his spouse. And I owe this information that I'm going to give you right now to a doctor by the name of Peter Martin, who is a marital therapist in Ann Arbor. And he doesn't treat alcoholics, not knowingly anyhow. Peter Martin, I asked him once after a seminar he was talking at, I said, Pete, what's the chief cause of sexual dysfunction in your practice? And he said, unquestionably, the chief cause of sexual dysfunction in my practice is hostility. Now, if the chief cause of sexual dysfunction in his practice is hostility, imagine how important hostility is in alcoholic marriages, where alcohol is the drug par excellence of hostility and aggression. So now I realize that there can be such a thing as a couple who have so much hostility and aggression going towards each other that they do become dysfunctional with that person because of the hostility factor. And yet for a period of time, before some of these other things I've talked about set in, they could for a period of time perform with relative strangers or casual acquaintances and so forth. Now, about 2 or 3 years ago, I started talking about the hostility factor during my talk, and there was a lawyer there from out east at the time, and he came up to me after the talk, and he said, "Doctor," he said, "are you suggesting adultery as a treatment for sexual dysfunction?" I was so shocked by his question, I have never failed to quote him from that time to this, because I want you to know that if there's any one thing I'm not suggesting is adultery for the treatment of sexual dysfunction. My suggestion is that you overcome the hostility and get on to the ability to perform and, of course, quit drinking. Which brings us up to this part of the talk that I want to talk about overcoming the hostility. And I, again, have to depend on Peter Martin for a baseline to discuss that, because during that same seminar, when Pete talked about hostility as a chief cause of sexual dysfunction, I said, "Well, how do you overcome how do you overcome hostility?" And he said, "Well, that's easy. You just form a perfect marriage." Well, he was, of course, talking tongue-in-cheek, but he did explain what he meant, and this is what he meant. He said, "Overcome a perfect marriage. You gotta overcome a hostility. You gotta form a perfect marriage, which a perfect marriage is like two trees standing side by side. Each tree able to stand on its own roots or its own feet. If you, depending on, you're talking about individuals or trees, and the two trees together are more protection than either one standing alone for the people in that marriage or underneath those trees." Well, now, that really makes sense to me, and it really makes sense as a recovering alcoholic, because basically that's what Al-Anon and AA is all about. Because Al-Anon is a form of therapy in which the spouse of the alcoholic goes to treatment or Al-Anon meetings, and he or she finds out how to be independent, mutually sharing, with reciprocal obligations, and stand on his or her own two feet. And then the alcoholic goes to AA meetings and finds out how to do the same thing, and the two together become two tracks, like two tracks of a railroad track, going in the same direction, never deviating, never meeting, but both reaching that reaching in the same direction. Happiness being, of course, a direction, not a destination. So I think we alcoholics probably are the most fortunate people in the world when it comes to forming a perfect marriage, because we have perfect treatment available to us to do that. There is some relationship here, however, to another philosophy that's very popular right now, and I'd like to talk about that for a minute, because it certainly helps the sexually dysfunctional alcoholic, sexually dysfunctional male, I should say, alcoholic or otherwise, and that's the philosophy of women's liberation. Women's liberation, you know, is the greatest thing that ever happened to the sexually dysfunctional male, because the females are telling us that sex is something they want to do with us. You know, sex at one time was something the male did for the female, you know. Sex originally was something the male did to the female back in the Victorian times, you know, and she was supposed to endure but not enjoy. Then the sexual revolution came along, and sex became something the male did for the female, and he was supposed to know where all the erogenous zones were and make sure she was satisfied, you know. And of course, we guys took our job seriously too. We read all the sex manuals, and we pretty much had it down to a fine science. And you guys know what it is. Sex became simply a matter of a peck of the cheek, a tweak of the breast, a dive to the clitoris, and stick with it till something happened. He's thinking he's God's gift to women, and she's thinking, "I wish God had picked this joker up and taken him back." He's thinking he's a real Don Juan in bed, and she's thinking he's more like a gorilla playing on a violin. Now women's liberation has brought us past that point. Sex is no longer something we do to them. Sex is no longer the male does for them, but sex is something the male does with the female. They have responsibility for each other, but to each other, but not. And it's a mutual type of thing. It's a sharing type of thing, and that's just great. You want to know how to overcome fear of performance? You remember the story I'm going to tell you right now, and you'll have it down cold. And the story. It's about a man and woman who met in a bar. They wanted to get to know each other better, so they go across the street to the motel, and she takes off all his clothes, and he takes off all her clothes, and the guy wasn't endowed too well in the sex department down there, and he looks down at her, and he, rather disappointed, he says, "My," he said, she looks down at him, I mean, and he wasn't endowed too well, and she looks down at him and says, "My," she said, "who do you expect to satisfy with that?" He looks at her completely undaunted, with a smile on his face and a twinkle in his eye, and he said, "Me." That's the way you overcome fear of performance. I think I'm about out of time, so I just want to close in talking about one other thing, I guess, and that's overcoming this hostility factor and forming a perfect marriage is pretty much sharing the type of things that I talked about this afternoon, because most of the anxiety and hostility in a marriage comes from the lack of interest in the other person, and most people think that people are falling out of love, if you will, and they don't realize that it's the alcohol that's causing this. And basically, it's important to realize that a relationship is an ongoing type of thing, and sort of coincides in a parallel line with the development of our sex life. Our emotional development, it parallels pretty much our sexual development, and our sexual development starts back in the teenage years, where sex is simply a matter of lust. It's sex for sex's sake and nothing else. And this progresses to that point where that we call physical intimacy at the time of marriage, where the couple surrenders their virginity, both of them, and through the intimacy they gain there, they continue on to a true emotional intimacy, which comes with years and years of living together. What most people don't realize is that alcohol reverses that process, and our sex life and our emotional life goes the other way. And this ends up in these feelings of hostility and aggression that people feel is falling out of love, and that the person doesn't care for them anymore, or actually it's simply a matter of the alcohol causing that. This is one of the other reasons, by the way, for premature ejaculation. I talked earlier about a type of premature ejaculation that's made better by alcohol. Well, there's another type of premature ejaculation that's made worse by alcohol because of this aggression factor. Sex can be a way for the male to get even with the female, and it can actually be an act of aggression. I can remember when I was a drinking alcoholic, I would have consultations with patients, and I would say that sex was an act of aggression. Now I realize that I was all wet at that time, and that was my own alcoholism talking, because the male at the time of ejaculation can have an attitude of take that, you SOB, rather than an act of love. This is not the true emotions of that person, but that's an emotion of the alcohol and alcoholism. So it's a matter of overcoming the hostility by communicating these things, and I think, of course, stopping drinking and learning to grow emotionally again, and I don't think anything is better for that than our own program of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. Thank you. What we would do is I'd sort of go over that same outline, talk about a few things that come to my mind, and get questions from the floor during the first hour also, okay? Okay? I don't know the answer to what you do when you don't have a bicycle, except every time I leave Brighton Hospital, and nowadays the nurses seem to ask me if I'm taking my bicycle with me when I go or not, and other than that, I don't know any answer to that. On primary sexual dysfunction, I don't know, sometimes I've been talking about this subject for so long, and some of the basic things escape me, and I think the things that come to my mind in primary sexual dysfunction is the reassurance of the people, number one, that sex is a normal function. I think that's important, but then I think it's also important to know just exactly what a normal function is. For instance, males, and females too, but males, especially during their teen years, are of course especially hypersexual, and they can have ejaculations, orgasms, three or four times a day, with a refractory period of only minutes between ejaculations, and that's normal. On the other hand, as you grow older, the refractory period increases so that
at age 70 or 80, it very well may possibly be as long as a week. And I think it's important to let people who are sexually dysfunctional know what is normal for them. The refractory period in someone, say, who is 50 or 55 in that area, usually is still measured in hours, and at most in a day or two. So I think it's important to know what you're aiming at as far as recovery is concerned, because a lot of times someone will come to you as an alcoholic who started drinking heavy when he was in his teens or early 20s, when his refractory period was actually minutes, and he thinks he's having a sexual dysfunction if he's now 45 or 50, and he can, and his frequency of intercourse is something less than 7 or 10 per week or something like that, you know, where you got to let them know what can be expected. Now, the average, of course, sexual outlets per week in the average adult male after he's 30 is probably 2.7 per week, according to Masters and Johnson's. The range can be considerably greater than that. I mean, there can be people in ages of 40, 50, and 60 who can be having daily or even more frequent ejaculations. But that, if you're trying to get somebody to be to get back to a point that's impossible physiologically, then you're not dealing with a sexual dysfunction. So I think it's important to know what to expect, but it's more important, I think, to not give the attitude that that age has anything to do with the inability to have sex. I mean, it's a matter of the story about the doctor there, where what do you expect if you're not able to function sexually at 55, what the hell do you expect? I mean, that's never normal, absolutely never normal, and so I think this is important. One of the other things that comes to my mind in this regard is the fact that erections in the elderly cannot be as tumescent or as rigid as erections during teenage years, and a lot of people who have had periods of impotence will find that when they recover, they are not having erections like they remembered in their teen years, and of course that sometimes never occurs. So I think you have to. When you're getting a history from a person, you have to be able to, know what the problem they are discussing to make sure that it's a problem, because some things can't are normal range. In other words, there is this refractory period, and you have to be sure of what their refractory period is. Now, one of the easiest ways to know whether somebody is having a physical reason for their sexual dysfunction, as far as males is concerned, is males, of course, have no dream erections morning erections if they're having problems with their testosterone levels. I mean, if they're actually having deficiency of testosterone, and of course there's some other things that can cause inability to have morning erections too that are physical, such as diabetes and that. But I'm talking now about the things directly related to alcoholism. If they have the inability to have morning erections after 2 months of abstinence from all drugs and alcohol, then of course that's an indication that there is a physical reason, not a psychological reason, for their problem. And replacement of hormone levels with testosterone injections can be tried, and usually will be successful if that person is not having morning erections. Now, the course of my particular practice, I'll probably not treat more than 3 patients a year with male hormones, and you consider that there are 1,500 patients a year roughly go through Brighton Hospital, you can see that this is not a big problem as far as male hormone replacement, but it is an important question to ask, because it certainly differentiates the physically impaired from the psychologically impaired. The fear of performance, one way or another, directly or indirectly, is probably going to account for most of the sexual dysfunctions. Inability to communicate, of course, being an integral part of that. I mean, if there's any one thing that I think causes a sexual dysfunction among married couples is going to be the inability to communicate, and we'll get more into more on that a little bit later. But this is one of the things. I think another thing that Masters and Johnson stressed when I was down there, and which is extremely important, is the methods of intercourse. Of course, are described in all kinds of textbooks, but except for one thing that very rarely is talked about, and that's who inserts the penis during intercourse. And this can make more males lose an erection than any one other thing. And if you were to pay $1,500 in treatment down at Masters and Johnson's, one of the first things they would tell you that is extremely important is the female inserts the penis into the vagina, not the male, because more erections are lost in that process than any other single process. So I think that little bit of information is extremely important to parlay to your patients. Okay, as far as the primary thing, I think that's the points I want to cover before we go on to the five different points of secondary sexual dysfunction. So if there's any questions in that regard, we can cover those now.
No questions on primary dysfunction? The question is for Dr. Morin, does he take testosterone levels in making the diagnosis or on clinical evidence alone?
The answer to that is no, and perhaps that's a fault of mine, but I really can't get excited about male hormone levels because I've worked in bioassay laboratories and I frankly don't have the faith in the results. And if I should ever have faith in the results, I certainly would do that. And so if I get a result and it's down, I still would go ahead and try the hormones.
The question is, does a diminished amount of thyroid have a causative effect on testosterone levels?
Can't say as I have any definitive information on that, other than in relationship to females. There's no doubt that when it comes to function of the ovaries, thyroid has plays an important role, and I certainly, when I was a general practitioner and had a lot of female patients, there definitely seemed to be a relationship to thyroid dysfunction, hypothyroidism, and ovarian dysfunction, and the fertility of that patient, and it definitely would seem to increase not only their desire but their ability to reproduce by giving thyroid. In fact, I know it did when they had hypothyroidism, but I can't say as I have much more to say about it than that. I don't just.
Does those available effect of
The only thing that I would say is I have seen some information showing hyperthyroidism depresses the luteinizing hormone so that you have less testicular and ovarian stimulation because of an overactive thyroid. But that works sort of like, is similar to the effects of exogenous cortisone. You know, if you take cortisone for arthritis, you're going to get a depression of the pituitary, which will affect the luteinizing hormone, and you can get testicular atrophy and atrophy of the ovaries. And the same thing can occur with excess of thyroid, whether it be exogenous or endogenous. But I really don't have anything really important to offer in that respect. I don't have too much knowledge in that. Yes?
Dr. Moore, what effect of the blood pressure medicines that we take nowadays have on primary dysfunction?
The question is, what effect does the blood pressure medicines that are used today have on sex function?
Well, they work, of course, against sexual dysfunction. A lot of them do. in a lot of ways, some of them understood and some not understood. The vast majority of your blood pressure medications, one way or the other, affect your vascular system. They dilate blood vessels. They constrict other blood vessels. Your ganglionic blocking agents. So they, in other words, dam up blood in some areas and circulate blood better in others. And so anytime you're dealing with something that affects the vascular system, the circulatory system, you're taking a chance of endangering the ability to have sex, you know. But there are a lot of other ways, too. For instance, reserpine, Raoul Wolfia's work on the hypothalamus and your neurohormones, such as the serotonin and the norepinephrine levels, and those have a suppressant effect on the sexual desire and sexual ability directly. I mean, this affects an important area of the brain that controls appetite, food appetite, as well as sexual appetite. Some of those things will have an effect on some people and not others. For instance, Inderil, propranolol, is a drug that can affect a few people as far as their sex life is concerned, but the vast majority has no effects at all. So there's some idiosyncrasies. You can say, you know, that it's very difficult to say that blood pressure pills have no effect on somebody's sex life. You can certainly say that this particular blood pressure pill or that particular blood pressure pill is unlikely to, and that certainly occurs. The ones that are unlikely to are Inderil, the thiazides, Diaryl, hydrodiaryl and diazide and that type of thing. They're very unlikely to. On the other hand, there are some that are extremely likely to, such as the reserpines, Raoul Wolfia's, Catapress, Aldomet is extremely bad. The Aldomet works on the central system too, in the brain too. That's a dopamine type of reaction, and that's hypothalamic again. But it's either, as far as I know, it's either through the central nervous system, the brain, directly affecting, suppressing the sex drive, or it's through the vascular mechanism.
The question was, does diabetes affect sexual function in any way?
Diabetes, of course, certainly affects sexual function. It's probably one of the more prominent causes of sexual dysfunction other than alcoholism and drugs. It is not the level of blood sugar that has anything to do with it, however, nor is it the control of diabetes. You can have your diabetes in perfectly good control and have absolutely horrible sexual function, and the reverse can be true. You can have your blood sugars bouncing all over the place and have no inhibition of sexual function at all. When I was at Masters and Johnson, they pretty much felt that the problem was at the spinal cord level as far as diabetes, and it was sort of a peripheral neuritis related to a peripheral neuritis or posterior horn mechanism. There are a lot of people, of course, who feel that diabetes is not a disease of sugar metabolism, but it's a vascular disease, and that's, of course, why you have the hemorrhages in the eyes and so forth, in the retina of the eyes, and there could be a combined posterior horn effect as well as a vascular effect with actual blood clots, emboli, and so forth in the pelvic vasculature system.
No other questions?
What is the relationship between prostate function and sexual function?
The question is, what is the relationship between prostate function and sexual functions?
The prostate gland secretes the vehicle of which sperm are ejaculated in. In other words, the sperm themselves make up a pinhead volume as far as the ejaculation, and most of the ejaculation is concerned of secretions from the prostate gland to carry the sperm out. And as a whole, the prostate gland doesn't have much to do as far as sexual desire or sexual ability, because people can have a total prostate gland removed and have absolutely no inhibition of sexual function other than the fact that they will not have any volume or very little volume, and the ejaculation may go back into the bladder rather than out the meatus of the penis. But as far as the sensation is concerned, it can be identical. The exception, of course, being if the nerve supply to the prostate gland has been interrupted too much, then there can be some decreased sensation at the time of ejaculation. But if everything goes the way it's supposed to be, it's a relatively benign prostatectomy. Is a relatively benign procedure as far as sensation is concerned, and it's just a matter of ejaculatory volume, and you may not even see that anyhow, because it may be ejaculated retrograde into the bladder, and then you don't see the sperm and seminal fluid in that until you urinate.
Yes. Tagamet. The question is, how does Tagamet affect your sex life?
Tagamet, unlike your other ulcer medications, has its effect directly on the parietal cells of the stomach as far as acid secretion. So, to my knowledge, it has no adverse effect on the sex life, unlike Bentyl and probenthine and banthine and that type of thing, which can have effects similar to blood pressure medications as far as both the ability to ejaculate. It can inhibit ejaculation, and it can, of course, change the blood supply in various ways. Okay, going on to secondary sexual dysfunction. We have the first group was the intrapsychic group, and there will probably be some questions that some people want to talk about that. It's a controversial subject, certainly with homosexual panic. A lot of alcoholics, when they think of being homosexual, they don't want to have two problems. You know, this is one of the things with being having sexual problems that originally they didn't want to talk about it at AA meetings and in treatment centers, because alcoholism at one time was a moral issue, and sex at one time was a moral issue, and anybody coming in from treatment didn't want to have two doses of being bad. They didn't want to be alcoholic and sexually bad too. And then you start throwing that word homosexual around, you get a lot of people straightening up and resisting the discussion altogether. I think that's one of the reasons why, by habit, I started covering it early in my talk, so people could get over the resentments they had about that and listen to the rest of the talk, I guess. But anyhow, the homosexuality, I mentioned the fact that homosexual panic exists, and in my mind it certainly does, and I implied that at one time the psychiatrist felt that all alcoholics were homosexuals, and I implied that this has been proven to be not true, and that alcoholics were not homosexuals, and it had more to do with homosexual panic or the fears of being. Well, what I said is absolutely true. However, there is no doubt that both males and females get a lot of resentments to the opposite sex when they're dabbling in alcohol and drugs, and all the arguments and resentments and hate that goes on, they do get some feelings, and they're not always good towards the opposite sex. And there are a lot of people who find having sex with someone of the same sex, or at least the thought of having sex with some of the people of the same sex, is more palatable to them than adultery. So if they are having problems with having sex with their spouse or a significant other, they may indeed entertain the possibility of having sex with somebody of the same sex for several reasons. Number one, because they have the resentments to the opposite sex. Number two, because they have feelings, some strong religious or other feelings against adultery, even though homosexuality they view as bad. In some people's mind, homosexuality is not as bad as adultery, so if they're going to cheat, so to speak, it seems more permissible to cheat with somebody of the same sex than the opposite sex. And number three, There's no commitment with someone of the same sex. There's no commitment to somebody with the same sex. People can have a one night stand, so to speak, much easier with a person of the same sex than with the opposite sex, because almost invariably a relationship with the opposite sex involves time and a commitment and so forth, and a lot of people are not willing to get into this. I think one of the things that came up by David Smith about homosexuals, and now I'm talking about the so-called pure homosexual, or the person who has identified themselves as being homosexual, not those people who may have had a homosexual experience. By the way, I think it's important to realize that a homosexual experience or two doesn't make someone a homosexual any more than a drink of alcohol or two makes somebody an alcoholic, you know. And way back when Kinsey wrote his report, he defined homosexuality as someone who had six or more homosexual experiences. So I think that that's probably not a bad definition of a homosexual, and so I think that's important to relieve people's minds too, because if it's not impossible for a very much of a heterosexually oriented person to have a homosexual relationship or a few homosexual relationships, and homosexual panic in those people could be a very serious incapacitating condition. So I think reassurance in this regard can be very important. David Smith, the medical director of Haight-Ashbury Clinic in San Francisco, points out that homosexuals, alcoholics, have the same similar problems as the female alcoholic as far as their sex life is concerned. You know, you might say, well, if you're committed to homosexuality, then you wouldn't have these intrapsychic hang-ups that I described for heterosexuals, but that's not true. Homosexuals become impotent or non-orgasmic, depending whether they're male or female, just like heterosexuals do. I mean, they react like the female alcoholic as far as their recovery, because they become depressed just like the heterosexual does, because of their alcoholism, but they're not likely to see their depression as caused by their alcoholism. In fact, if they go see a psychiatrist, invariably that psychiatrist will say, you're depressed because of your homosexuality, and they'll get them to try to either accept their homosexuality or convert to heterosexuality if that were possible. And I'll talk about that in a minute, since now there's some talk in the by Masters and Johnsons that homosexuals can be converted to heterosexuals, and they were talking about that when I was down there several years ago. But anyhow, David Smith said that homosexuals are a lot like females when it comes to their reaction to their alcoholism, because the female sees their spouse, as I mentioned, as the cause of their depression and their miserable sex life, not their alcohol, so they sort of crawl into the woodwork and not do anything about it because they don't realize the problem is with the alcohol, not the prince. And the same is true of the homosexual. He sees, or she sees, her homosexuality as the cause of their depression, not their alcoholism, and so they are difficult to get to treatment and hard to treat, because one of their primary things that bothers all of us when we come to treatment is we're feeling miserable. A lot of us see at least the direct connection between our misery and our alcoholism, where this is less so when you got such another major problem here facing you, like homosexuality. It's easy to believe that it's not the alcohol that's making you miserable and depressed, but it's your homosexuality. So they're harder to get to treatment. Masters and Johnson's just published some statistics in the recently. It reminded me of what they told me when I was down there. I had sort of forgotten about it until this article in Time magazine this week, and that sort of refreshed my memory about all that, and that 47% of homosexuals, they were doing that work when I was down there, as I said, and they said that 47% of homosexuals could be converted to heterosexuality, but that's a statement that has to be viewed in relationship to their interpretation of that, and I want to give you some background information that I think will help you understand what they're saying, one thing they're saying is that all humans are sexual animals. They're neither absolutely heterosexual or absolutely homosexual, but they can respond sexually, and they just have a preference. Well, Masters and Johnson's stuff is saying is that you can take someone who has a an identification or a preference for being a homosexual and let them and make them or help them or to enjoy a heterosexual experience. And the way they apparently are doing that is they first studied heterosexuals and found out what their sex lives were like, and they found that heterosexuals heterosexuals who use heterosexual techniques, mainly intercourse, exclusively for their sexual outlets, have 25% less orgasms than heterosexuals who use a combination of heterosexual and homosexual techniques. In other words, heterosexuals who use masturbation, partner manipulation, and oral sex, in addition to intercourse, are going to have sexual outlets four times more frequently than heterosexuals who use intercourse alone. Now, what the Masters and Johnsons have done is teaching the homosexual who wants to become a heterosexual these facts and letting them know that all human beings are sexual animals, not with certain orientations. In other words, they're giving the homosexuals permission to use their homosexual techniques in heterosexual relationships, because heterosexuals, after all, are doing it too. So that doesn't seem to be asking too much. So in this regard, they can convert 47% of homosexuals to successful relationship with heterosexuals. And that's all that study means. I mean, it's sort of lost in the scientific jargon there, but I was there when they sort of deciphered all that information in group sessions down there. So it was easier for me to pick that out of the Time magazine than what it may be if you haven't had it explained to you on the basis of, like, when I was down there. In other words, this is something that I have sort of suspected for a long time. Anyhow, I thought about the thing that if you take a homosexual, an avid homosexual, if you will, and put him on a desert island with a female and leave him there for 5 years, I got a feeling that homosexual would end up in a heterosexual relationship of some kind before the end of those 5 years. I mean, that's basically what Masters and Johnson's studies are showing, and I don't think that that's unusual. I think the reverse could also be true. I think that if you take a heterosexual and put him on a desert island with a homosexual, with a man of the same sex, I should say, or a woman of the same sex, the same thing would probably occur at the end of before 5 years was up. So basically, I think that if both heterosexuals and homosexuals are given the freedom to use a lot of different sexual techniques, they could probably function in more situations than they otherwise can imagine themselves doing. Okay, we can. This particular topic then includes the homosexual panic, castration complex, virgin whore concept, penis envy, someday my prince will come theory, and so forth. If anybody has any questions in this range of interpsychic hang-ups, in other words.
Any questions in this field? Let's go on to the next one.
Questions? Okay, I always learn more from these workshops than the people who are attending them, I'm sure, so I appreciate any comments or questions anybody may have, because it can be a learning experience for me. If not anybody else. Okay, the second group of the secondary sexual dysfunctions was the state-dependent learning thing, the idea that we remember things we learn better drinking, and we learn things we learn sober better. And this means, I can think right now of a patient we had at Brighton Hospital last month who... Both he and his spouse insisted, of course, that He functioned very well sexually when he was drunk or drinking. And the explanation for this is simply in my mind that these people have the ability to, they do not have the ability to perform sober, so if they're going to remain sexual at all, they do so under the influence of alcohol. This, of course, is related to the original thing. One of the things I didn't cover at all was how it was suspected at one time that alcohol was an aphrodisiac, you know, and then they explained that it really wasn't an aphrodisiac, that alcohol made your sex life better because it relieved your inhibitions. Now they realize it does have, through that testosterone mechanism, it does actually increase the male hormone level, so it in both sexes, so it does make, it is really an aphrodisiac. But there's no doubt that it also relieves inhibitions. And this is, and it, I don't think there's any alcoholics in this room that don't realize, that doesn't realize that alcohol gives you feelings of omnipotence and makes you feel all powerful and all strong. I mean, I think Joe Kirby last night mentioned how it made him taller and bigger, you know. And I heard one of the gals from his general service office last year at an AA talk, she was a little overweight and too tall, and it made her shorter and slimmer, you know. And that's pretty much the way alcohol does for all of us. Whatever it is that we want out of it, originally we can get out of it, we can get that. So you take a person who uses alcohol and drugs to get these feelings of omnipotence and uses them starting way back in his teen years, he can really go through some sexual gymnastics that can be very pleasant to a co-alcoholic or a non-alcoholic partner, and when he or she sobers up, because they have less ingenuity in their sexual acts and absolutely no ability to perform sober because they never did, then their sex life can seemingly be very boring in comparison to the way it was. And occasionally I hear that from a person. And until I heard Dr. David Smith talk, I didn't realize, I didn't have an explanation for that other than the one that was originally given, way back when I was in medical school, that alcohol relieved inhibitions and therefore made you more daring and that type of thing. Related to this, I think, perhaps, is with the female alcoholic, is that drunk is seducible. I think that in a lot of males' minds, probably most males' minds, drunk is seducible, and so therefore alcohol carries with it its own sexual stimulation, on the one hand, drunk is seducible, and on the other hand, alcohol gives you an inferiority complex. So if the alcoholic is, let's assume that we're talking about a male alcoholic who has got low feelings about himself and poor feelings about himself, comes in contact with a female who is sober and knows who she is and where she is and so forth, he is less likely to be able to make out or even want to try to than that same male with an inferiority complex coming in contact with a female who is drinking and who, in his mind, a drunk is seducible, then he's got the ability to try to seduce or make out. And, of course, you have to have the courage to try before anybody becomes successful. I mean, if you don't try, you're not going to get any place. So I think that's one of the things that's working as far as this state-dependent learning thing. Any questions in that regard?
Yes. Say again, please.
In regard to learning things while we're drunk, and then say we drank a lot when we were teens or during learning periods, not regarding testing in other areas, would this have quite an effect?
The question is that those who drink when they're young and learn, have an experience of learning at that time, does this have effect at a later time?
Yes, very definitely in a lot of ways. Number one, of course, is what, as I sort of alluded to this morning, just our plan. A lot of different reasons for blackouts, and And one of the explanations for them is simply because we learned something while we were drinking and we forget it when we're sober. That's one of the explanations for them. But I remember, right at this time, I remember an English professor from the University of Michigan who was a patient at Brighton Hospital and who left there and stayed sober for a period of time, and then he came back for the second time. And when he was in the second time, I give this talk, a talk similar to this, talking about state-dependent learning. I happened to use it in a different lecture at that time, but I talked about it anyhow. And he came up to me after the talk, and he said he was really grateful to hear about that, because that's one of the reasons why he didn't stay sober when he left Brighton Hospital the first time, because he was an English professor and had learned all of his lectures under the influence of alcohol. And when he left Brighton Hospital, he couldn't remember how to give his lectures. And he was really disconcerted, to say the least, about that. And so he went back to drinking and found, of course, he could give the lectures drinking. And he happens to live in Ann Arbor, of course, where I do, and I see him at AA meetings all the time there. And I know that what he did the second time he left Brighton Hospital was go home and reread his own lecture notes and learn them sober. And he's had no trouble at all since then. So I'm sure there's all kinds of situations like that that pertain.
Any other questions in this field?
Okay, the third group then was the organic ones, where there's actual changes in the body caused by alcohol and drugs that keep us from performing sexually because of the changes in the body. And of course, in some ways, we've already talked about that in relationship to the vascular system and diabetes. So, I mean, these are not individual, separate, isolated categories. There obviously is overlapping here. But and in this group, I usually think of the effects of male hormone on the male hormone. And as I said, when I was in Masters, down at Masters and Johnson's at that time, they were just doing the studies on marijuana. And they found that heavy use of marijuana, 3 or 4 joints in any one night, lowered the male hormone level for the following 6 or 8 hours. And if it was down for only that long, then you lost sexual desire. Daily use of marijuana for a 2-month period of time lowered the male hormone level down for the following 2 months, and if it's down for that long, then you lose the ability. Both sexes involved, of course. Now, that since I left Master Johnson's, that has been expanded to alcohol and Valium Librium, and the same is true in each one, and the time period is pretty much the same. You know, I mean, a few days for the desire, a few months for the ability. And I can't remember the name of the place in New York that expanded that information to show that actually what happens after 2 months of use of alcohol, it's the luteinizing hormone of the pituitary gland that gets suppressed. When that gets suppressed, then it doesn't stimulate the testicles or the ovaries to produce their endogenous male hormones. So then that's why it lasts for so long. So this is a physical thing, and it's got something to do. The same mechanism could be involved with the thyroid thing that you were talking about, although I really haven't seen anything followed through very much in this regard. The recovery from that, I've already talked about. It takes a couple of months. It can take us, of course, a lot longer. I mean, you know, I'm sure this group knows that the half-life of Valium is incredibly long in some people, much longer than the 2 days that Roche Laboratories is now willing to admit to after a considerable amount of pressures. But Brunel Fox in California claims it's as long as the half-life of Valium in some people as long as 8 days. And from my own experience with patients, I can believe that completely. So if you're one of those people who metabolize some of these drugs very slowly, 6 months, even a year, would not be too unusual to see the suppression of these hormones for that.
Yes, Dr. Moore, I'd like for you to discuss this. The question is the effect of, if any, of the non-orgasmic male and the effect of on the femininity of the female, and vice versa.
Let me see if I understand the question. Rephrase it. Are you saying the bad feelings that come in the female when her husband or significant other becomes impotent and vice versa.
She fails to stimulate him, I think. She loses her femininity because she fails to stimulate him in non-orgasmic states.
She fails to stimulate him when he becomes impotent. You mean she physically fails to, or psychologically?
Psychologically
fails to. Okay, well, I would think that we basically are talking about the whole field of resentments and hostility and low self-esteem that gets going here. Because if a male becomes impotent, I'm quite sure that he has a similar reaction to the female that the female has when it comes to someday my prince will come. I think the female sees when she becomes non-orgasmic. I'm sure it's easy for her to see because she's been told, or easy for her to believe that it's her spouse that's responsible because she was sort of raised that way. Well, I think when the male becomes impotent, he hasn't been raised that way, but he certainly, as a drinking alcoholic, is anxious to believe that if he had someone younger and or more beautiful or more skilled in their sexual abilities, that he wouldn't have this problem. In other words, he's seeing her as the cause of his impotence, just like the female is seeing the male as the cause of her non-orgasmic response. Even though the male hasn't particularly raised that way. That's more of a cop-out, but it's easy for him to see that, to believe that, because indeed, everybody knows that if you have some stimulating literature or something, you're, especially for males, they say, although I understand Playgirl is really selling good now, so I guess the reverse is true. You have some stimulating literature or person, you can overcome certain amounts of impotence. So I think that, and this is the whole principle, of course, behind males looking for somebody younger when they to marry and that when they get older and all that sort of thing. But I think it's basically boils down to two factors that you're talking about, or I see it anyhow. One is the low self-esteem of the male, and the other is the hostility factors towards that partner, towards the female partner. We talked a little earlier at lunchtime about something that never ever occurred to me before until I was sitting in a group confrontation at Brighton Hospital last week. One of the people there was the family, our family counselor, who is a female and who is an Al-Anon member. And what happened was the male was there, and she was giving him permission to go home and feel equal with his non-alcoholic spouse. And it never occurred to me before that the male or the female, for that matter, wouldn't feel equal in a relationship at home. You know, and I thought back in my own drinking time, and I completely agreed with her when she said it, but because that's exactly the way I used to feel. I felt when I walked in my house, they say a man's home is his castle. Well, it was anything but anything but that for me, because I walked in that house, I felt that she owned it, she controlled it, she ruled it, and I was allowed to come in and sleep. And so I was feeling inferior in the confines of that house. I didn't feel my kids respected me. I didn't feel that if any major decisions came up to make, if I didn't agree with what my wife said, then I was wrong and she was right, and which was for the most part was right. I mean, she usually was, of course, because my judgment was impaired. But nevertheless, I was feeling inferior. So I think this is what what I feel here that attitude is just magnified by being impotent, because if you feel impotent, not only are you inferior in the social sense of that relationship and the ability to discipline kids and so forth. This is a castration complex you're talking about. I did talk about that in the where you live, but you got a certain image of what a father, a husband, and a male is, And if you're not able to live up to that, either one, because you're impotent, two, because nobody will listen to you and be disciplined by you, three, because you're not supporting your family anymore, your wife may be out working or something like that, this whole bad feelings come in there. And then when, as far as her, he is not necessarily going to see that as alcohol, but he's going to see her as hateful and aggressive and so forth, and therefore not loving enough. If she loved him more, then he would be able to function more. That's just another way of not admitting what the real problem is. With the female, of course, I think the picture would seem to be about the same. We talked at the break here about low self-esteem is even more devastating to the female. I mean, I think the female alcoholic really needs to feel good about herself in order to have sex. And I think this probably all goes back to the virgin whore concept, too, in a subconscious level, that she has to feel good about herself in order to enjoy sex life, have a good sex life. And so when she becomes non-orgasmic, I suspect it's got something to do with more of the bad feelings, and she, of course, has got the permission to blame her spouse in this regard, and the hostility factor, I'm sure, is functioning there. Is this what you had in mind? Or?
Yes, I
wonder whether they're an alcoholic or not. Right. Okay, I agree with that. And if the female, if the male, that's one of the big hang-ups. Well, yeah, I see what your point is now. And the same thing is true. If the female becomes non-orgasmic, the male is, this is a hang-up with him because he's not much of a man if he can't, right. And that's, this, of course, then we get right down to the fear of performance again, and the ways to overcome fear of performance. Incidentally, we could talk about that for a second now, because the way to overcome fear of performance, of course, according to Masters and Johnson's, is to take the emphasis off of performance and put it on pleasure. They do this, of course, with what's called the sensate focus down at Masters and Johnson's. And if you, this morning I talked about that continuum that we had, where our sex life starts with lust and goes on to physical intimacy that happens at the time you surrender your virginity, male or females, which is a tremendous opportunity to get to know somebody, of course, and that's probably why God invented it that way in the first place, until you get to the type of emotional intimacy that comes with years of marriage. And alcohol, of course, reverses this thing down to this lustful stage. And it occurs not only with alcoholism, but occurs with all kinds of relationships, so that people have an inability to communicate. And one of the things we talked about at lunchtime was the fact that the big problem with sexual dysfunction, when you really boil it down to the lowest common denominator, comes down to the problem of communication. If you can communicate with your spouse, you can get over your sexual dysfunction. That's basically what it boils down to. And sharing some of the physical aspects and blaming alcohol is a very real beginning as far as the communication, but sometimes it takes more than that. And taking the emphasis off of performance and putting it on pleasure becomes extremely important, and that's what basically Masters and Johnson's theory is. And alcohol reverses this process and makes your sex life go down to this lustful stage. At least in a lot of cases, it becomes, when you recover from alcoholism, you've lost the ability to communicate to such an extent that you're at this physical intimacy stage at least. And how are you going to get from this physical intimacy stage that, fortunately, because sex is such a great thing, we almost invariably at least can start there again. I mean, that's where our emotional involvement started, usually when we got married, say, or whenever you had that relationship start, and then it grew from there. Well, fortunately, for the most of us, we still have we'll get back the ability to have sex, and that puts you back at this stage, and then you got to start growing again. Well, the way you grow is, of course, through intimate relationships and communicating, and most of us alcoholics have, instead of growing, have learned to play games. And, of course, if you read that those books like I'm Okay, You're Okay, and Games Alcoholics Play and Games People Play, you realize that that's what started in here. Instead of growing and getting to know each other better and better and having a better, a more intimate emotional relationship, we started playing games like Cops and Robbers and Look What You Made Me Do games like and Rapo and various games as described in those books. Well, when we stop drinking, we have a tendency to continue playing those games, even though we're sober. And if we play those games, we're going to continue to lack in growth, in emotional growth, and our relationship will not become of that high order that it otherwise would. And Masters and Johnson suggests that you overcome this by what's called sensate focus. And sensate focus is a way of getting into this continuum right at this point of physical intimacy here. And sensate focus, if you were to go down to Masters and Johnson's or read their book, The Pleasure Bond, is a way of taking the emphasis off of performance and putting it on pleasure. And if you were to pay your $1,500 or whatever it is down at Masters and Johnson's, they would send you over to the Chase Park Plaza Hotel after doing a complete physical and explaining the physical aspects of sexual problems, including who inserts the penis. They would tell you all these important things. And then you would go over to Chase Park Plaza, and they'd tell you to both take your clothes off at least twice a day and get into bed, and with the following instructions. You don't touch the male or the female genitalia. You don't touch the female breast or any other erogenous zone, such as the rectum and so forth. And you don't have intercourse for 3 days. And you're instructed to for the male to use the female's body for his pleasure. Notice that. It's not, he uses the female's body for his pleasure, not her pleasure. And her only job is to tell him what is uncomfortable to her psychologically or physically. Then it becomes her turn, and she is to use the male's body for her pleasure, not his pleasure, and his only job is to tell her what is uncomfortable to him psychologically and physically. This brings out the emphasis of pleasure, and you find out that there is a beauty in a relationship without orgasm, without ejaculation, without anything like that. This is something an awful lot of females had the pleasure to talk to in the last few years have known for a long time that males are harder to teach, that there is a pleasure in a relationship that does not involve orgasm or ejaculation. This is what Masters and Johnson teaches you to do: take the emphasis off of performance, put it on pleasure, and sex is something that's going to happen eventually. And it's only because of this fear of performance that it keeps it from happening. And this allows these people to start communicating. In other words, the book by Alex Comfort on Joy of Sex and More of the Joy of Sex does the same thing. It gives the people the ability to communicate with their hands and so forth rather than verbally. So this is important. When I talk to people on a one-to-one basis about this, invariably I say no 3 days in bed naked with no sex. The male will almost invariably raise his eyebrows and say, "Wow, how are you going to tolerate all that stimulation?" I always say, "Well, that's just a typical male attitude. There's some myth going on around here around this country that says when a male goes on to have an erection, if he doesn't go on to ejaculation, something horrible is going to happen, like brain damage or something like that, you know." And the actual fact is this doesn't happen, of course, and the fact that they're worrying about that erection proves the point. I mean, the fact that this thing, by taking the emphasis off of performance and putting it on pleasure, is the whole mechanism for communication and recovery. What it boils down to, again, is it's a matter of communication. You take a couple who are able to communicate on an honest level, a total honest level, then I think you got someone who will not have much of a problem with their sex life. One of the profile of a recovering alcoholic, as far as George Mann is concerned of Minneapolis, Minnesota, is somebody, number one, who is abstinent, number two, someone who has a good feeling about himself, number three, someone who has a loving relationship with another individual, number four, someone who has a contact with his higher power, and number five, someone who has extreme honesty high level of honesty with the ability to confront and be confronted by their partner. And I think if you get those five qualities in that profile, I think sexual dysfunction will disappear. Any other questions? Covered. Let's see, the next one was functional dysfunction, which I just sort of more or less mentioned in fear of performance and the sensate focus. Last one is the hostility factor. Somebody asked me during the break about the these two trees I had on the board, and she had to leave, and she didn't have time to wait and ask the question, so I can sort of explain in a little more detail what I mean by those two trees. If you recall, overcoming hostility is to form a perfect marriage, according to Peter Martin, which is like two trees able to stand on their own feet side by side, and the two together being more protection for the two people underneath those trees than either one standing alone. And she wanted to know in more detail what that meant. And basically, what it means is a perfect marriage is composed of two people who, and they have three qualities. One, they're individually independent, they are mutually dependent, and they have a reciprocal obligation. And that's what basically these two trees represent. Either one of those trees could stand alone on either side of the board, and they could survive. But the two together, overlapping like this, is like the boughs of trees on either side of a street. They overlap in the middle of the street, and anybody walking down the street gets protected from the sun and the rain and so forth underneath those trees, and they get more protection than if there was just one tree on either side. So they have a mutual dependence. In other words, what you don't want is one tree leaning on one tree. Or worse yet, one tree leaning away from the other tree. When I used to give this talk up till a few months ago, I used to say it doesn't matter whether one tree is dominant and one is recessive, whether one is tall and one is short, but I changed my mind about that, and I think that feelings of equality are essential for a good relationship, and that's why I bring in this women's liberation thing. I think that for a relationship to be real and to grow and to communicate, there has to be a feeling of equality, and I didn't really realize that so much as the other day when Stephanie brought up that fact that you giving this male the permission to go home and be equal, so when she said that and I looked at this man, I realized how important a feeling of equality was, and I have to plead a little chauvinistic attitude with my attitude I had last year in not realizing that. I didn't mention the need for equality before because I didn't see it as important as I did when I was sitting in that room with that man, and I realized that was equality, that need for equality is important. And I apologize to all the females that I may have talked to up to the time that I changed that, because I really think that equality is extremely important. But what you don't want is one tree leaning on one tree and one tree leaning away. And then, in addition to that, you have to have a mutual commitment or a reciprocal obligation, if you will, to stay there and not move. This tree's got to be able to depend with reasonable certainty that tree is going to be there tomorrow, or the relationship, of course, will deteriorate. Any questions?
The question is, does alcoholism and alcohol have any effect on fertility, particularly as far as the sperm count is concerned?
Yes, it does. The sperm count does go down with alcoholism, and with the drop of male hormone level, there is also a rebound increase in sperm count with stopping drinking. It's usually not a significant one as far as fertility is concerned, unless the count is already down, because the number of sperm is, that it drops is, you know, it drops like 250,000, 250 million to 200 or something like this, and it's usually not significant, although we have had, in the last few years at Brighton where this subject has come up, we've had two people who had problems impregnating, two men who have had problems impregnating their spouses, that where we did get sperm counts on them, they were down, and there was a, and they were down significantly, and they have since, both of them had children. But it's usually not, as a rule, but there's the sparsity, there's a lot of sparsity of information here, and I was just reading something the other day of somebody doing some more work in this field, but it definitely has a depressant effect on the sperm count.
I have to give Dr. Moran a standing ovation for his workshop this afternoon. Give you a little idea of how much we appreciate your being here, Dr. Moran.